now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
I'm a longtime fan of science fiction, and it was disturbing to me as I've kind of fallen away from fandom over the recent years due to other time constraints when I did look in on it recently to find that the genre has been more or less overwhelmed by progressives. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a gentleman who has been on the receiving end of their wrath. He is in the rather unique position of being a six-time Hugo nominee, six nominations this year, one nomination quashed, removed, disqualified in a questionable judgment, to be charitable. And then in all five categories in which he remained nominated for the Hugos, the award was given to no award. He is a former lawyer, newspaperman, and newspaper editor. He is an author, a prolific author, and an author of some skill. His most recent works, The Count for the Eschaton Sequence, which is still in progress, and two that I have read recently, which I found extremely intriguing, compelling, and has gotten me excited about reading for pleasure again, Awake in the Nightland and Somewhither. He's also the author of a collection of essays, Transhuman and Subhuman, Essays on Science Fiction and Awful Truth. It is our honor to welcome John C. Wright to the program. John, thanks for joining us today.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
I don't know if I want. Well, I guess since I opened the can of worms, I might as well jump right in there. The Hugos. I remember when I was a teen and reading everything I could get my hands on by the likes of Larry Niven and his sometimes co-author Jerry Pournelle, and noting that Larry was a multiple-time Hugo nominee, sometime winner. When I began paying attention to what was happening to the Hugos over the last 2 years, the award seems to have lost some luster in the last few decades. What has happened to science fiction as a genre? Isn't it just in entertainment for geeks these days, or has something changed?
There's two parts to the answer. Before the movie Star Wars came out, science fiction was a very small ghetto of literature. The numbers were small enough that a well-read science fiction fan like myself could be familiar with every book he had read. And so the discussions among us were... I'm sorry, I've just lost your...
Oh, no,
I can't hear you.
You're probably hearing the yard tractor going by the front yard. It's a beautiful day here in the Ozarks, and my wife is out on the Troy Belt taking care of the acreage. So you may hear some noise in the background.
Let me continue then. I don't know if the audio is picking that up, but I'll continue. After Star Wars, science fiction exploded as a genre and moved into movies, television, and so on. And nowadays, we live in what I consider to be the golden age of science fiction. Many people say that the golden age of science fiction was John W. Campbell's Astounding Magazine, Analog Magazine, back in the 40s. But I say it's now. You can turn on the TV and see a science fiction show or go to a blockbuster movie, and the top rated and the top money makers will be science fiction stories. But at the same time, the little ghetto did not disappear. It merely moved away from the mainstream of what science fiction fans were paying attention to. The Hugo Awards in the last, I would say, between 15 and 20 years have been occupied by a hostile force of, I won't say foreign elements, but I will say people who don't have science fiction as their primary love in life, their primary goal in life. These people refer to themselves as social justice warriors, mm-hmm. a term which we apply to them with some smirking cynicism because they're neither sociable nor just, nor are they any sort of warrior. They have since decided that that word is an insult to them, even though they're the ones who pinned it on themselves. And so they would prefer that we call them CHORFs, which is an acronym invented by my friend Brad Torgerson, who was in charge of the rebellion against the social justice warriors this year. Now, in your introduction, you called them progressives, and that is sort of true, but sort of not true.
again, being charitable and using a label that they tend to prefer for themselves.
I don't think these people are truly progressives in the classical sense. Progressives, at least when I was young, favored a colorblind society and favored judging each man by his merit and wanted to eliminate racism and wanted to eliminate all injustices and unfairnesses in society. That's taking them at their word as to what they say they want. The social justice warriors want there to be racism. They just merely want it to be anti-white racism. They want there to be no colorblindness. They want there to be whoever the designated victim group of this news cycle is, to give them all sorts of awards and privileges and pats on the back and to diminish and overthrow the patriarchy of white Christian males, which they regard in the same light as Karl Marx regarded economic capitalism.
Hmm.
So, in other words, they have a paranoid, delusional system where they assign all blame to a certain scapegoat, and they seek forever to rectify the ills of this imaginary injustice.
Hmm. So,
now,
in terms of
science fiction, all that means is that what they want in science fiction is they say they claim falsely that there have never been.
Yep, still there.
I am, but I'll wait. I'll wait because I can't hear when the tractor goes by.
I tried cutting it off, and it wasn't quite quick enough on the trigger.
What the social justice warriors want in science fiction sounds at first like a reasonable request. They say there have not been that many women in science fiction. There have not been many blacks. There have not been many people who are afflicted by sexual malfunctions, and so we would like to have more of them placed into science fiction, both as characters and as authors. And the response to that is, of course, to say, well, the genre was started when Shelley wrote Frankenstein, and she was a woman. The lady who wrote the second Star Wars movie, Leigh Brackett, was in science fiction before John W. Campbell Jr. was. Ursula K. Le Guin is an award-winning, I will use the word genius of the genre, and no one ever tried to exclude her from anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so the claim that we were trying to exclude, that science fiction has a history of excluding women and minorities, is simply false.
Hmm.
In the same way that the number of beer makers in America all happen to be German because
right.
that's what their cultural tradition is, or that the number of makers of fine instruments are almost always Italian, there's no shame in saying the kind of people who are interested in rocketry and the space program tended to be young white males, tended to be middle-class teenagers. So they start with the lie that there was an injustice done to minorities. And to correct this imaginary ill, they want to give awards to minorities, not based on the merit of the work, but only based on their minority status, or if they have minorities as major characters.
Hmm.
By doing that, they're taking the main purpose of telling stories, which is to entertain and edify, and turning it into a tool of propaganda. And I'm using that word in its original sense of meaning they're trying to promote and spread what is fundamentally a religious view. It's not the Christian religion. In fact, it's an anti-Christian religion. It's a comprehensive view of the world that explains all things and explains away everything it can't explain. It's as comprehensive as Christianity is. Christ demands the whole person from his followers. Likewise, these people, these social justice warriors, demand everything from their followers. And unfortunately, that means there's no room left for good science fiction. So the upshot of it is, and I'm talking too long, the upshot of it is that the science fiction awards mostly greatly influenced by a few people. A man named Patrick Nielsen Hayden at Tor Books is the ringleader, is the spearhead of this, have been giving awards to works that were remarkably inferior in quality.
Mm-hmm.
I would use a word that I can't use on a G-rated radio program to describe it. But I'll just say terribly, I mean just abysmally bad writing, the kind you would find in most high school level writing courses, were being given awards merely because they checked off certain checkboxes on the social justice warrior list of various politically correct opinions you have to hold, or various victim groups you have to have as characters, or if the author is from the overseas, or if he's got a darker skin color than I do, then he's good to go.
Yeah, it does.
Now, Mr. Larry Correa, what happened is about 2-3 years ago, Mr. Larry Correa, a friend of mine, decided that he wanted to show that the Hugos were being given to inferior works based on these social justice criteria, based on everything but the merit of the work. So he, as a joke, said that giving science fiction awards to inferior works was causing something called sad puppy syndrome that made puppies cry. And if you were not a heartless person, you would want to make the puppies happier by making sure the science fiction awards went to science fiction that was actual science fiction, that had real science in it, or that had real fiction in it. Like I said, he wrote maybe one blog post on this topic. He emailed a few of his friends, and then he got on the ballot. Well, the reaction was outrageously over the top. If you to anyone who doesn't know how these people think or doesn't know how they work by mob tactics. They work by mau-mauing people. They work by a ginned up outrage, artificial outrage, and they are addicted to outrage the way a crack addict is addicted to crack. They love outrage, mm-hmm. And when they can't be outraged at some real injustice, they
invent one.
Say,
sure.
They invent one, but there's no – excuse me. I have to be more clear about that. Real injustices don't interest them. When they hear about Christians being decapitated in the Middle East, mm-hmm. That doesn't even stir the slightest feather of their interest. They don't even raise an eyebrow at that. But purely imaginary injustices, such as the alleged exclusion of women and blacks from science fiction magazines in the 40s and 50s, was something that never happened. That allows them to pump up extreme outrage. Now, Mr. Correa happens to be from Portugal. He is Hispanic, I believe is the word that the social justice, that the progressives use to describe their fellow sons of God. I myself always thought that Spain was part of Europe, and so I would have assumed that someone from Spain is from Portugal is a Caucasian, but evidently not.
What do we know?
So he was referred to as a bigot and a monster and a woman hater. He was called a woman hater because he would teach women how to defend themselves with firearms against potential aggressors, against rapists and such. And so the act of teaching him for women to defend themselves, the social justice word interpreted to mean that he thought women were incapable of defending themselves without a firearm, which is an insult against women, which means that he's pro-rape or something.
No, boy. They better not get a hold of the gift that the ministry I'm working with is giving away right now during National Preparedness Month. It's a kit intended for women to learn to prepare and to offer them some tools for preparing themselves against physical assault. So I guess we're in the same category.
Well, these people are addicted to outrage, yeah. And the addiction can only be fed if the outrage is false. And so they will make claims that are 180% 180 degrees. Excuse me, I said percent, I meant degrees, away from the truth in order to show their loyalty to the principle, which they want to show that they're more loyal to their principles than to the truth. So they will speak untruths with blithe abandon and expect to be patted on the back for it. And they pat each other on the back for it. So a year later, Correa thought his point had been made. He said, this is a political award. It's being given by politically correct people to people who write politically correct stories. It is no longer a science fiction award. But some of his friends said, let's see if we can save the award. Let's see if we can get the award to go to someone who actually writes good science fiction. Now, I have two publishers. One is Tor Books, and Patrick Nielsen Hayden is one of the chief editors of Tor Books, maybe the chief editor. And I also was contacted a few years back by a micro publisher in Finland, mm-hmm. Theodore Beale, who goes by the pen name Vox Day.
Right.
And Vox Day is the Darth Vader of science fiction.
Indeed.
Everyone in the establishment, all the social justice warriors, not only hate, loathe, and despise him, but they stay awake at night sweating, trying to think of what else they can accuse him of being. He's not a very nice man, but he is a very logical thinker.
Mm-hmm.
And so he writes me out of the blue and says, do you have any short stories you want to sell me? And I said, sure, because Tor Books was not interested in selling any anthology of my short stories. The two anthologies that you read, that you mentioned in the opening segment, mm-hmm. were from him. Okay.
Yes, yes. And that, so, it was his blog that led me to your work and to what was going on in the Hugos. Also led me to Monster Hunter Nation by Larry Correa, which I highly recommend.
I also will recommend Monster Hunter Nation. I read all the Monster Hunter books, and I read the Hard Magic books, and they're just delicious. They're just delightful.
Yeah.
They're just lovely. So, to continue with my long, rambling narrative, on the second year, Vox Day and Brad Torgerson wanted to join the effort, but there was a disagreement as to long-term goals. Vox Day, who was more cynical than some of the others, said, "The Hugos cannot be saved. These people will blow up their own award. They will vote no award rather than allow anyone who is a conservative Christian to win a single award." And we said, and I was proved wrong, we said, oh, no, no, there's enough people in the field who are interested in quality science fiction that won't happen. So the Sad Puppies, led by Torgerson, published a suggested list of readings and asked people to join and vote. Now, the overwhelming response was most people said, I didn't realize I could vote for the Hugo. I didn't know it was a popular award.
Really?
Yeah. Anyone who reads science fiction is allowed to vote in this award. And our answer was yes. The reason why these social justice warriors got their offal, onto the ballots so many years was because no one was voting against them. They were running unopposed. See? Vox Day, being a little more cynical, said, no, no. They're going to no award everything that we get on the ballot. Therefore, I'm going to post a slightly different list that's going to emphasize Castalia House. Castalia House is his publishing company. And I'm going to put the best author I know on the ballot. And, of course, he, for better or worse, he thinks that's me. I'm not going to argue with his opinion, though. I think he's overestimating my skills. Be that as it may. So the number of people who agreed with him as to the state of science fiction was so much larger than the people who agreed with us. When I say us, I mean the Sad Puppies. When I say him, I mean that he called his group, as a joke, he called it the Rabid Puppies.
Mm-hmm,
because
yes.
They were quite angry with what had happened to science fiction. We're people who love the genre, who have been here for years, and when we voiced the slightest polite disagreement as to the direction the genre was going, that it was serving a political goal of a political party that we didn't agree with and we're not members of, we were called all the most vicious names in the dictionary, including some names from other languages, and we were savaged in the international press. Our opponents decided that the wise thing to do was to give a press release to Entertainment Weekly, which Entertainment Weekly simply repeated word for word,
which was
the most
shocking.
Accusations,
yeah,
of bigotry and homophobia and racism, and called us neo-Nazis. Neo-Nazis? Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
So. But of course, to the social justice warrior, the more outrageous the accusation is, the less true it is, the better it is for them. See, because they make the accusation to express emotion, not to convey any facts.
Right.
So, from Entertainment Weekly, other national news services picked this up. So the Hugos, for the first time in ever, became a matter of national public radio, and they all followed the same party line because they're all members of the same party. They're all progressives. They're all social justice warriors. And so they repeated these outrageous lies. They called Brad Torgerson, who happens to be married to a lovely black woman, a racist.
Yeah.
And then when he posted a picture of him and his wife and their child online, he was accused of using his wife as a shield to protect him from accusations of being a racist. This is how disconnected from reality and how loyal to hell these people are. They will say anything their father, the father of lies, mm-hmm, tells them to say, with no slightest scruple of shame or guilt, because they don't have an idea of true and false. They don't that notion never occurs in their head. They don't believe in the truth. They certainly don't believe the truth is a person the way you and I believe.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, so I was unwilling to go to the Hugo Awards, even though I was up for 6 nominations. I have to correct you. I think the disqualification, while it was their appearance, I not technically was illegal. I had posted a unpublished, uncorrected manuscript copy of my story online, and for many years now, the Hugo Committee has said that online publication, even if you don't get any money for it, counts as a published work. And that was, and it was 8 days before the deadline, so it was published last year, technically speaking, not this year. Now, the only thing that makes that slightly dicey is that is that the author of Old Man's War, John Scalzi, had done a similar thing with something that he later won an award for, and the precedent should have controlled the case. But the Hugo Award Committee is different. The membership is different every year. So this year's committee felt they were not bound by a previous ruling.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think
it doesn't make any sense to my legal mind. That just seems like, you know, Cthulian logic to me. But the story that they quashed was not really a science fiction story at all. Actually, it was a fantasy story. So be that as it may, I'm not going to complain about that. I don't think they made it an unjust ruling. Though I do think that the ruling was, because it didn't follow precedent, was dubious.
Yeah, and I don't think people would be surprised to find out that Scalzi is on the list of approved authors for those who consider themselves part of the social justice warrior cast.
If you have read Vox Day's website, you have seen the statistics on how many of these social justice warriors have given each other awards,
yeah,
and how many times they've been nominated. A man named Mike Glyer has 49 or 50 nominations. Now, that's not in 1 year. I still hold the record with 6 in 1 year. But the reason why I have that record is because Vox Day said, let's all vote for John Wright to his fans and to his readers. And his readers read my work, and they had the same reaction you did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me explain why I don't think that reaction is unusual. When Vox Day said, do you have any short stories to sell? I said, I have 20 years of short stories. I have an entire lifetime worth of production of some of my best stories that have never seen the light of day. I've never seen print. So the stories I should have been winning one award per year for the last for the last 5 years or 20 years all came out in 1 year. So I don't think it is unusual or even strange that I got this many fans who were willing to put my name at the top of the nomination.
Okay, yeah. Of course, the fun thing is like a group that comes out with a dynamite album, a multiple Grammy award winning album, and their debut. Then you know the trick is can you repeat that next year? So.
That is in the hands of the Muse, and I believe the Muse works for the Divine Lord, so I will leave all those questions to him.
Right.
So to make a long story even longer and more boring, I went to the award ceremony. They no awarded all the categories where I was in, and the only award they gave for a story was to the guy who took the spot of the story that had been booted out. My story had been booted out. This short story was a story about the world turning upside down when a guy loses his girlfriend and he puts her goldfish in a soda bottle and is going to try to climb along what is now the roof of the world, now that the ground is now overhead and the sky is underfoot. He's going to try to get to her, but she's dead and the guy she cheated on him with is dead and she was cheating on him too, and he jumps into the sky or something. It was not science fiction. It's barely even a story. It's just terrible.
I have
nothing against this author. I'm sure the guy's a perfectly nice guy, but his writing style is absolutely juvenile. The emotions of his characters are absolutely flat and jejune. And the story that I wrote that got quashed was the most difficult story I ever wrote, because I was writing about the justice of God and the deaths of children. I got a tear-stained letter from a reader who said that he'd had a child die in his life, and that my story was the first thing that happened to him that gave him the strength to carry on. And he was blessing me and thanking me for writing a story. So I can say with all fairness that letter to me is a much greater reward than any rocket ship award given by a bunch of people who only give awards to their friends and only because their friends support a abortive and disgusting, destructive philosophy known as progressivism.
Yeah.
Well, so I care. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to stop writing the kind of stories I write to please the establishment, because I'm trying to please my own author.
And it seems to me, and from having read your and been reading your blog now for some months. I suspect you would agree here. Well, in fact, I know you do, because I've also read, you know, most of Transhuman and Subhuman.
No, I never agree with anything I read on my blog.
That keeps them guessing, because they never know exactly how to attack.
No, I'm kidding. I'm a very honest man. I'm very straightforward.
That this is symptomatic of a bigger problem in society.
Sure.
How would you diagnose the ills that afflict us in 21st century America?
That's a very broad question, but I can answer it in three words. I would say atheism, anomie, and anarchy. Or if you don't like those words, I would say creed, character, and code.
Hmm.
This is what I mean. Nothing comes from nothing. Nothing comes from nowhere. The laws of a nation spring from the moral character of a nation, and the moral character of a nation springs from its religion. Now, even nations that don't have an official religion still have an religion. They still have a worldview that is based in the supernatural that informs their natural, their view of of nature, their view of man, and their view of man's role in nature. Pagan or heathen nations tend to have toward a very melancholy and fatalistic worldview where they think, for example, in ancient India, they thought that the universe was set up so that there was a caste system, and that this was ordained by the gods, by the laws of nature, and by the supernatural. But the gods themselves were also controlled by fate, which was ineluctable. Fate was not something you could change its mind. It's not something your tears would matter. A Christian who believes that man is made in the image and likeness of God cannot strike at the image without insulting the god any more than you could step on a coin that had the face of the king on it in the old days when they would put kings on the faces of their coins without insulting the king. So for a Christian nation to, let's say, for example, abolish slavery was a perfectly logical thing to do. And in the Middle Ages, you notice that even though slavery had been rife in the Roman Empire, by the time the Christians took over, there was no civil war in you know, 5th century Europe to abolish slavery. It just faded away because it was alien to the Christian worldview. It unfortunately came back again in the 15th and 16th centuries. But be that as it may, your worldview informs or directs or controls what your character is, and your characters control what your laws are. So once you eliminate from your creed, your set of beliefs, the fundamental basis of what you think reality is made of, that will change what your culture is, which is your habits and your virtues and your vices. And once those change, what seems reasonable and unreasonable to you, what seems just and unjust to you as a group, to you as a nation, will also change.
Mm-hmm.
Once you eliminate God as the center of your life, then you no longer have an anchor for saying that human beings have rights. If there's no God, then there's no law above human law. If there's no law above human law, there's no basis on which to judge a law to be just or unjust. The law is simply the law. There's nothing above it that you can use to overrule it. And so once the law is just the law, when the Supreme Court, for example, comes out with a completely outrageous and illogical finding, which is not based in anything it previously decided, it's not based on precedent, and it's not based on logic, then for a godless person, for an agnostic or an atheist, he has to say, there is no law above the Supreme Court to which we can appeal to overthrow this. We have no basis on which to rebel. Worse yet, we have no basis on which to rebel against our own vices and our own sins and our own bad character, our own temptations. So when a temptation, like a sexual temptation, which springs from the strongest instincts of the human character,
mm-hmm.
the most powerful drive in mankind is the romantic drive, is the erotic drive. When a perversion of that, like sodomy, becomes not only allowed but sanctified as being a constitutional right, then if there's no law above human law, there's nothing to appeal to rebel against our own inner weaknesses, against our own sins, against our own devil. And if you can't rebel against the devil sits on his throne of the world unopposed.
Mm-hmm.
And so once your laws change, your respect for law, once the laws become unrespectable, your respect for law goes away and you have anarchy. Anarchy is not a system where there's no laws. Anarchy is a system where the laws don't make any sense. Anarchy is a system where the government doesn't obey the law, okay? And people just make rulings as they wish according to whatever is expedient for that day. Either the Supreme Court or the president or whoever happens to be in charge. Tyranny and anarchy are just two sides of the same coin. It's both forms of lawlessness. So once you eliminate God, you eliminate the idea of truth and principle. And once you've eliminated principle, you've eliminated law. Once you eliminate law, you have anarchy. You have anarchy both on a personal level of people living their lives simply abased and enslaved to sin. Then you have anarchy on the social level where you have people simply enslaved to the state. That's the cause, and that's the effect, as I see it.
Hmm. And you have, in almost Orwellian fashion, you know, bad is good, good is bad, beauty is ugliness is beauty. It does seem to be a world turned upside down.
It is a world turned upside down, because once you eliminate God, then you flip the world upside down. There's no you have no anchor on which to build your worldview. You have no principles on which to build your philosophy, mm-hmm. except for the imaginations of your own heart. And the heart of man is depraved from the beginning.
Right.
So I disagree with you very sharply at one point. It's not almost Orwellian. It is pure Orwellian. The social justice warriors who attacked me and attacked the sad puppies for being racist, bigoted, homophobic, women-hating, flying purple people eaters were saying things that were exactly the opposite of truth, which they either knew or should have known was exactly the opposite of truth. And they repeated it at increasingly more extreme volumes, merely out of what I will call party loyalty. Now, I use that word with some exceptions. It's not actually a political party. It's a religious party. It's the religion of Antichrist. It's the religion of anti-Christianity. It's the philosophy of anti-Western philosophy. It's the worldview that holds Western free market liberty, Europe, and the white male to be the enemy, and that utopia would arise if only we could eliminate Christianity and everything that Christianity has created. That is to say, Western civilization.
Yeah,
I agree with a writer named Hilaire Belloc that Western civilization is in effect the Christian church expressed in society.
Yes, well put. I run into this recently, and it seems to be occurring more and more frequently. And as I went back and reread one of your essays in Transhuman and Subhuman, was surprised to find that you had identified the same sentiment in the Grandmaster Arthur C. Clarke, his classic work Childhood's End, which, as I understand, is going to be a coming soon to a television near you on the Sci-Fi Channel, there's this idea in the mind of atheists that if Christians would simply just wake up and snap out of it, that somehow through the use of some miraculous time machine, we could be shown a picture of the apostles spiriting the wounded but still living Jesus down from the cross and out of Jerusalem under cover of darkness to go off to south of France with Mary Magdalene and create the plot of the Da Vinci Code, that we would suddenly abandon all of these ridiculous notions that have been entertained by brilliant scholars for 2,000 years. I ran into this the other day. In fact, somebody posted something extremely offensive about the Kentucky county clerk, Kim Davis, accusing her of being just like, or that her worldview was identical to that of the Islamic State, because she's trying to impose her religious view on others, just like Sharia law.
Orwellianism again.
Yes, ignoring the fact that she didn't try to execute the two gentlemen who came in looking for the marriage license.
She was on the receiving end of the tyranny, not on the delivering end.
Right.
And to the Orwellians, saying the opposite of what is true is merely par for the course.
Mm-hmm. The thing that astonishes me, though, is that there are people out there who are convinced that Christianity is such a ridiculous religion that even though scholars, learned men who have devoted their lives to study, have been convinced of its truth for two millennia, they can somehow debunk the entire belief system of Christianity and refute the truth claims in the span of a single tweet. It is astonishing that there are people who actually hold such views.
I used to be one of them. I used to be an atheist for most of my adult life and almost all my childhood.
Well, that was the segue I was going to lead to here. Because you
at the time, like most atheists, I thought Christianity was a scientific theory, and like any theory, could be disproved by a single contrary example. I didn't take it to be a theological theory because I didn't understand that theology existed as a discipline.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't treat it as a philosophical theory because I had contempt for it.
But
so consequently, I tended to dismiss it as an explanation that could easily be shown not to be valid.
But you at least developed to a point where you say in your writings that you did at least get to a point where you understood that Christianity was a little more complex, was not something that as Arthur C. Clarke writes in Childhood's End, that these the slans, the overlords, can show with one you know, trick of technology.
One TV shot.
Exactly. The religion is false, and somehow the billions of believers would suddenly say, okay, fine, we give that up now. We're going to live according to an age of reason. You at least gave Christianity a little more credit than that. But there was a point at which...
Not really. No, I did not give it any more credit than that. I merely had a stronger sense of honor that required me to treat it as if it was an honorable enemy. Not as if it had any innate value in itself. I thought it was like believing in Santa Claus. I thought it was as ridiculous as believing in Santa Claus and as easily disprovable. All you got to do is go to the North Pole and see there's no fairy tale castle there.
Gotcha.
And there's no reason to believe in Santa Claus.
But there was something that changed your mind. And I think for somebody who obviously is well-spoken, well-read, and, you know, to be an attorney newspaper man, you know, requires some ability to put thoughts together to reason, utilize reason and intellect.
Newspapermen do not have that facility and don't have that ability, as you would know if you read newspapers. that comes from my character. I'm a philosopher. I'm someone who's in love with truth and always has been. And I went to a very good school called St. John's College in Annapolis and was trained in the classics and read St. Thomas Aquinas and read Aristotle and read all the very most logical thinkers in history. And that shaped my character, and that's what gave me that sense of philosophical honor that required me to treat my enemies as if they were to give them the benefit of the doubt and to act as if their claims, no matter how ridiculous they seemed, I had to answer them point by point.
Okay,
that's what Austin Clark lacks. He lacks honor. It's not that he lacked intelligence. He was a perfectly intelligent man.
Yeah, true.
He just was not willing and not able, perhaps intellectually not able. You got to keep in mind, the Christian spirit comes from heaven. The Holy Ghost comes into our minds and into our souls and changes us so that we have faith. The atheists don't have that. They can't even comprehend it. It's not even part of their worldview. Mm. So, of course, to them, we look like we're something, people who merely made something up in the imaginations of our hearts, that we just made it up one day. We just fell out of bed and made it up. And so if you think it's something you fell out of bed and made up, they think you can unmake it up as quickly. That's why they have such contempt for us. They also have I speak as one of them. They also have this opinion that – they also have the same – I'll call it the paranoia worldview. They have the same paranoid conspiracy theory worldview as a Marxist or as a modern feminist, mm-hmm. where they think that most of mankind – doesn't agree with them because most of mankind is wicked and wretched and unintelligent, mm-hmm. and that there's some sort of oppressive system in place, some sort of secret conspiracy in place that keeps most men in ignorance.
Yeah.
And to a person with a conspiracy worldview, you think that if you can merely strike at the conspirator, that suddenly the sunlight will break in through the prison wall and everything will be illuminated, everything will be made clear.
The
reason why he thinks that a brief tweet can shock someone out of their delusion is because he thinks it is a delusion.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
The stupid evil genius theory. It's so brilliant that it's enslaved billions for 2,000 years, but so stupid that it can be debunked in a single blog post.
It is, in fact, indeed, is the stupid evil genius theory.
Yeah.
If Marx were right, all he would have to do was to publish his book once. Every worker would say, hey, I don't need to work for a capitalist anymore, would quit his job the next day, and in 24 hours the world would be utopia. Mm-hmm. Now, that didn't happen. If the feminists were right, all they would have to do is say, hey, I'm being oppressed by men. I will stop dating them, and then they'll come here on bended knee with flowers in their fist to make apologies to me. But that doesn't happen. That didn't happen. See?
Yeah. What was it that changed you from being a somewhat convinced of
It happened in two stages: a natural stage and a supernatural stage. The natural stage was slow, and over a period of 5 or 10 years, is. My atheist friends all started going slowly crazy, and they started going crazier and crazier. By which I mean, I don't mean my personal friends. I mean atheists on the public stage. There had not been that many before 9/11. And after 9/11, several prominent figures arose in the world of letters, people like Christopher Hitchens, mm-hmm. and Dawkins and the like, who made embarrassingly stupid pro-atheist arguments that were, as an atheist, an embarrassment to me. Because they were making very weak arguments that were historically illiterate, based on emotion rather than logic, and were simply stump stupid and foolish. And I should hasten to say that does not mean in and of itself that the claims are false. Merely because someone on your side is making a weak argument doesn't say anything about the merits of the argument itself. I'm just saying this is what drew my attention to the fact that my side didn't have a hammerlock on the truth because it was being so poorly defended. So I started rereading, and I'd read them in my youth, C.S. Lewis's works on God in the Dock. And from him, I was led to read G.K. Chesterton. And
oh, yes.
When I was reading G.K. Chesterton, I was reading a man who I felt was my previous incarnation in life. He and I are the same weight. However, he's much more literate than I am, and he's much funnier than I am. I wish I could copy his geniality, his sense of good humor. He never seems to get angry at anyone, and I seem to get angry all the time.
Yes, my wife has just read the collection of Father Brown mysteries and just read The Man Who Was Thursday. In fact, we just Netflix just delivered the DVD set of the old BBC series Father Brown. So she's encouraging me to read Chesterton as well. So
I just read Man Who Was Thursday to my children. For their bedtime reading story, and it was just delightful. But in addition to, like me, he's a newspaper man, but in addition to writing, he wrote mysteries and I wrote science fiction, but he also wrote essays, as do I. He also wrote biographies, and he also wrote apologetics. If you have not read his Orthodoxy, then you are in for a treat. You are in for the best book you're probably going to read all year if you read Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton.
I'm making that note now.
I promise you that if you buy the book and you don't like it, send me the check and I'll pay you back for the cost of the book. Okay, and I've made this promise here on the air, so you can hold me to it.
Right. Okay.
In any case, here's what has to start happening. My friends, the atheists who were on my side, and we had the hammerlock on the truth, and we knew the reality, and everyone else was deceived and filled with the folly and illusion. Everyone else believed in Santa Claus, and we were the only guys who were awake. Okay, but our side was saying, we should remove the microscopically small cross from the top of the Spanish mission appearing in one quarter of the city seal of Los Angeles, because that is a unfair imposition of religion forbidden by the First Amendment. Now, as a lawyer, I can tell the difference between a real legal argument and a word I can't say on the air.
Right.
Pure sewage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a sewage argument. And that argument was so bad and was so filled with sewage that I clutched my head with both hands and I said, fellow atheists, we do not believe in magic. We are atheists. We believe there's no such thing as the supernatural. We don't believe in spells. We don't believe in witches. We don't believe in goblins. And we don't believe in giants. Okay? So why do you think that this symbol on this seal has some sort of magic power over us? I thought we were the guys who didn't believe in magic. So what's wrong with you? Then other atheists were trying to get In God We Trust removed from the money and the Pledge of Allegiance and to have the Constitution removed from the Constitution. And we were just doing things that were stump stupid. We're just embarrassing, okay? And I said – and they – my fellow atheists were – the other thing that happened to me is at about the same time, two of my friends who were both Christians and have been Christians their whole lives – both told me in private conversations that they thought adultery was permissible under the Christian rules, under the Christian lifestyle. And I said, no, it's clearly not. Don't you know your own side? And keep in mind, this is me talking to an enemy. This is me saying, you know, it's like, it would be like meeting a communist who had never read Marx. And I was like, well, haven't you read what your leader says your rules are? And they said, no. If you're in love, love will make it so that you can do unlawful and illegal things that are specifically forbidden by both Jewish law and condemned by the apostles and condemned by the church for 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, wait a minute, that can't be. So in the meantime, I'd undergone certain changes in my life. I had a child. I saw my nation attacked in 9/11,
mm-hmm.
and I realized that my previous atheist worldview could not explain the duties I owed my nation and the duties I owed my children in a sufficiently in a philosophically accurate fashion. I realized my model was wrong. I was like an astronomer who thought that the moon would have an eclipse and it didn't on the proper date. So I knew there was something wrong with my model. I knew there was something wrong with my theory of the universe. So I sat down and pondered. And I realized that the only way to organize a society so it doesn't fall apart is to have families. The only way to have families is to have marriage. The only way to have marriage that is fair to women is to have monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to have monogamy is to have a series of values and virtues where you can control the sexual impulse and divide it between what is lawful and what is unlawful, what is licit and what is illicit, what is natural and what is unnatural. And I suddenly found myself at odds with all my atheist friends and with the entire world, because logic had forced me step by step from believing that I, as a father, had a duty to my child, to believing that all fathers had duties to their children, to believing that one of those duties was to provide them with a safe upbringing, to believing that a safe upbringing required a secure marriage, to believing a secure marriage meant a lifelong, divorce-free, contraception-free mating between man and wife forever, which required love,
mm-hmm.
which and that you must have laws to penalize deviations from this, and you can't have laws to penalize those deviations unless you have a moral code, a set of values, and a philosophy of life shared by the whole society, which condemns sex outside of marriage, which condemns self-indulgence, which condemns intemperance, which condemns injustice, and which condemns immoderate behavior. So the only place you can get that is if you believe in virtue, if you believe in truth, justice, temperance, moderation, prudence, those things. Okay, I'm not talking Christianity now. I'm just talking about classical virtues that every pagan as well as every Christian used to know. And my atheist friends were 180 degrees opposed to this in every respect. See, they didn't like justice. They wanted minorities to receive special privileges. They didn't think every man should get what he deserved. They thought that some special people should get extra goodies. They did not believe in temperance. They believed that you should just do what you felt when you felt, provided the impulse was authentic enough. That was the argument of my Christian friends who said that love excused fornication.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't believe in prudence because they thought that to stop and calculate how you should behave was immoral. Not that prudence was imprudent, but that prudence was actually immoral. They thought you should act spontaneously and impulsively to do whatever you feel is best at the time when you feel it. And that's what they had. That's what they claimed as their moral code. Okay.
And so on.
They had flipped all of the classical virtues on their head. They lived in the upside down world. And I looked around at the environment. And I said, "How come I am the only guy standing upright in the upside down world, except for my hated enemies, the Christians? What is wrong with them?" And I said, "What went wrong with our society that we became addicted to sex so badly that we're willing to embrace injustice, unfairness to women, and even kill babies in the womb in order to protect the sacred idol of fornication?" Now, being a non-Christian at the time, I didn't use the word idol, but that's what I was thinking, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They had taken an idea and elevated it to the highest throne of their love and devotion. They had made it into something they worshipped. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not being a Christian, I could not say they're worshipping a false idol. But even as an atheist, I could see as a matter of logic that they had taken a lesser thing, the sexual pleasure that comes from a marital union, and elevated it to a throne above the heavens,
mm-hmm.
and that threw off their entire rest of their system, because they then permitted the murder of babies, lying to women, treating women like dirt, a lack of chivalry, a lack of courtesy, a lack of honesty. They had overthrown all other virtues for this one thing.
Essentially, turning the clock back to about 1500 BC, because what you're describing is essentially the state of affairs in Canaan at the time that Moses was ready to lead the Israelites, into the promised land. And God told them, don't do all of these things, in the books of Leviticus and
there you are being unfair to the Canaanites. They had marriage. They had polygamous marriage, but they had marriage, and they only sacrificed their firstborn to their horrible heathen gods.
Yeah, it's true.
They didn't do it for their personal convenience. They did it to appreciate their gods. I'm not making a joke. We are lower on the scale of morality than they were. Our society is worse than the Aztecs when it comes to killing human beings.
Right, because at least their gods were telling them, do this and I'll give you that. Here we're just doing it because it's inconvenient.
For personal convenience. Now, so I looked around and I saw that my fellow atheists were wrong on every single point of social, political, economic, and philosophical matters, and as wrong could be. And my hated enemies, the Christians, were as right could be. And worse, the most ancient repressive, cruel, and foolish of the Christians, the Catholic Church, agreed with me on one point, and that is, I said to myself, how did I get to a point where my best friend cannot tell the difference between sex within marriage and sex outside of marriage? He cannot tell the difference between love and romance and mere personal gratification. I asked him about sex outside of marriage, and he said, "Oh, it's like a sport. It's like mixed doubles tennis. It's merely something you do to entertain yourself." And I was stunned. I was flabbergasted because I said, "Someone has robbed all the romance, all the chivalry, all the delight, all the mystery, all the grandeur, all the glory, and all the pleasure out of sex for my friend, who at the time thought of himself as something of a ladies' man.
Hmm.
But he knew nothing about women.
Mm-hmm.
All the delicacy, all the poetry taken from him. And I said, who did this? And as an atheist, I found myself in agreement with the most outrageous branch and the most ancient branch of the Christian belief system, which was the Catholic Church, who said it's contraception. It's the free use of contraception that did it in. And I found out that all the Christians used to agree with the Catholics before 1930s, before 1932. It was the Anglicans, the same guys who gave us homosexual priestesses,
yep,
who first said, no, we should allow this in certain circumstances. Well, so I reached an impasse. I said, my hated enemies, the Christians, are right about absolutely everything important in life except for this one question as to whether or not God exists. And my friends, the atheists, are absolutely wrong about all the most important things in life except for this one question about whether God exists. How can that be? If one side has the hammerlock on truth, if one side is true and the other side is not only false but ridiculously false, believing in Santa Claus level of ridiculousness of falsehood, how can that be? So I sat down with the Summa Theologica to try to read through the arguments to try to see if there was a logical reason to believe in God. And the weight of the book defeated me. I looked at I read one page, and it's hard going, mm-hmm. especially in Latin, and it's much crisper and much more logical than I remembered it being in my youth when I read it in school. And I said to myself, self, there's no way if God Almighty exists, he would expect an illiterate peasant in the Middle Ages to read through this gigantic book to convince himself that he existed. There's got to be, if God is real and God is fair, then it's got to be a fair way to find out whether he's real or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, as a philosopher, as an empiricist, to perform an empirical experiment. I got down on my knees and I said, dear God, I know you don't exist. I can prove it with a logical argument as clear and concise as the arguments of Euclid proving that opposite angles are equal. But as a philosopher, I know that I could be wrong, and so I'm willing to give you this opportunity to prove to me that you exist. Show yourself to me in some fashion that I can't deny or explain away, and save my soul from the damnation that you are threatening me with, and I'll believe in you. And if you can't, then you're not omnipotent because you lack the ability to do something. And if you won't, then you're not benevolent because you're damning me to hell without you know, I'm giving you this opportunity to show yourself to me. And then I got up and brushed my knees off and I said, honor satisfied, I now can disbelieve in God with perfect equanimity because I've done all that I can do as a philosopher mm-hmm. to try to experimentally show that the result exists, that the reality is the way it is. The next day I had a heart attack and was in the hospital.
Boom.
And while in the hospital, had a vision and saw the Virgin Mary and was visited by angels and archangels and apostles and the persons of the Trinity. And I felt the Holy Spirit enter my body like wine being poured into a cup.
Hmm.
I got out of the hospital about a week later, and I was still in bed a month later when I had a second religious experience. Before I went into the hospital, a few minutes before I went to the hospital, I turned to my wife, who was a Christian Scientist, and they have a long, 100-year-long history of faith healing, of healing by prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, either take me to the emergency room or call one of your Christian Science practitioners, because they have a long history of healing people through prayer. And as an atheist, I was willing to give them the chance. So they got on the phone with the practitioner who healed me immediately. The pain in my chest stopped. I mean, I shouldn't say pain in the chest. I was dying. I was sweating. I was screaming. I was on the floor. Okay,
wow.
I was about to die. And this Christian prayed, and it stopped. And I said, huh, that's a weird coincidence. How could that be? Because that can't happen in my worldview. There's no spot in my perfect model of how the universe works where that could have any entry point. That what just happened to me can't happen
mm-hmm.
unless it was a pure coincidence. But if it was a pure coincidence, then why did this guy say that what he was going to do when he said his prayer was exactly what was going to happen? You can't predict a coincidence before it happens, can you?
No.
Okay. Now, the other possibility is that I was just deceiving myself. But if I'm deceiving myself, then how can I turn my heart off and on? that's not a power human beings have. One of the things that came to me in the hospital when I was in a vision is when Christ said to me, at the end of time, God will not judge you. He will not condemn you. But I will be your judge. Now, at the time when I saw that in my vision, I said, this has to be a hallucination. This has to be a dream. Because Christ never said that, and he never would. All the Christians I know agree that God is very judgmental, and he throws people into hell all the time. Well, 2 weeks later, after I was out of the hospital, I was reading the Bible, as you might imagine, having just met the author of it.
Exactly, yeah.
And I came across a passage in a book I had never read before in my life, because atheists don't read the Bible, where it said word for word what Christ just said to me. Now, there's two possibilities here. There's two possible models of how to explain those facts. One, Christ is a real person who spoke to John the Apostle and to John Wright and said the same thing because he's the same to both of us.
Mm-hmm.
Two, I have psychic mysterious powers that allow me to read a book 2 weeks in the future and send my brain waves back into the past and create a hallucination in my own brain by means of my hallucination creation power to read to me something in a book I'd never read before, and I was tricking myself by means of magic. Now, as an atheist, I'm not willing to believe in magic or in Christ, but if I had to choose between the two, the first theory makes more sense and coheres the reality more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. I got a miracle. I got a vision. I got a religious experience after that. I've had several miracles since. I had so much evidence. After praying to God for evidence, I had so much evidence flung into my face and shoved into my brain and screwed into the very roots of my soul itself that I urge people not to pray for things unless they really know what they're asking for.
Exactly.
Someone is listening and someone will answer you. They may or may not like the answer when it comes.
Well, I had somebody once tell me that they wished that they would hear audibly from God, directly from God, like the prophets of the Old Testament. And I said, have you read the stories of Ezekiel and Jeremiah? Do you know that Elijah was so depressed he wanted to kill himself? I mean, be careful what you ask for.
There's a blessing that Christ says to doubting Thomas. He says, blessed is he who believes without seeing. And I don't get that blessing, so I don't want anyone to be envious that I heard the audible voice of God. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He said the same thing to me, he says in the Bible. There's no I didn't get any mysterious, you know, messages about the Holy Grail or anything. It was pure. What I got was straight, pure quill Christianity. He's already said everything he needs to say to you. And he's already told you what you need to do, and you just don't want to obey orders.
Hmm.
Well, I'm not speaking to you personally. I mean you, those Christians who may be envious of me having heard from the Virgin Mary. Okay.
You know,
she's very disappointed in the way you've behaved, I should say. No, I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding about that. That didn't actually happen. I'm making that up. That was a joke.
John, I try to keep these programs to about an hour in length, just to keep them to manageable, bite-sized sections for folks. And we've only
out of time.
No, not at all. This has been thoroughly enjoyable. It's gone way too quickly, and I would love to have you back again if your schedule allows.
I will be happy to talk with you again because you're the only guy who's interviewed me so far at the start of the prayer, so I know your heart's in the right place.
Well,
since you probably have a dozen questions on your list that you haven't gotten to, why don't we do this again sometime?
That sounds like a wonderful thing. John C. Wright, author extraordinaire, and I've turned some friends onto your work, especially Awake in the Nightland seems to be really resonating with folks. It's haunting.
Can I tell you a secret?
Yes.
I wrote that when I was an atheist.
I'm not surprised.
I'm sorry. You should be. If you're not surprised, then my craftsmanship is deficient.
No. Well, we can talk more about that in the future. But again, it is a beautiful work and haunting. In fact, one of my friends was so caught up in the story of the Nightland and the setting that he's gone back and he's found the original novel online and purchased a copy, used, I think.
I think the haunting quality deserves to go to William Hope Hodgson, who's the original author.
Yes.
I just wrote a story set in someone else's background.
Yeah.
So to be fair, a lot of the credit goes to the original author, not to me.
Well, your ability to maintain, because I read a little bit of the original novel. I've got stacks of books that are waiting for my attention, so I've not finished it. But it seemed like you captured the haunting setting of his original work very well.
If you read Null A Continuum, which is my book set in A.E. Van Vogt's world of Null A, you'll see I have just as much skill at capturing the pulp flavor of that original.
Okay.
Van Vogt is my favorite author from the old days. And I'd like to, if you have me back, I'd like to talk about him and about some other things as well.
Van Vogt, yes. And in fact, one of the essays in Transhuman and Subhuman, you argue that he should be considered one of the big three of science fiction.
Yeah. And if you have me back, I can follow up on Arthur C. Clarke and his Gnosticism. I believe he's pursuing a Christian heresy without even being aware of it.
That was something that I made some notes on today. So, that, yeah, that's on the list of questions we didn't get to today, but we will definitely talk in the future. John thoroughly enjoyed it and highly recommend Some Wither. Looking forward to the follow-up books in that series as well.
Okay.
Check the show notes at vftb.net for a link to the website and blog of John C. Wright, a very interesting fellow and a gifted writer. Again, highly recommend the series of short stories collected in the anthology Awake in the Nightland. I commented during the interview that I was not really surprised that he wrote those when he was still an atheist, because there's some doctrinal things there that I suspect he would not have included in those stories had he written them after accepting Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. But having said that, still worth a read. Interesting stuff. Just don't read it for doctrine. A statement which applies to any work of fiction, my own included. So, I also recommend his most recent story, Some Wither. Again, a ripping yarn, especially if you've got a young adult or teen male boy in the house. It's the kind of thing that when I was, 13, 14, 15, I would have thought just totally awesome. Now, bearing in mind that John is Roman Catholic, and there are some Roman Catholic, there is Roman Catholic doctrine in those books. Just, bear that in mind. And there are some folks who really have an issue with accepting Roman Catholics as fellow Christians in the faith. I'm not going to debate that or discuss that now. Sharon and I, on the last 10 years, have discussed issues that we have with the Roman faith. We've also been critical of certain points of doctrine held by Protestants. And as Paul McGuire said in an interview that I had with him and Troy Anderson, his co-author on a new book called The Babylon Code, the Roman Catholic Church is not the only church with an official hierarchy. It is not the only Christian church with a hierarchy on the planet. And we Protestants, if we're going to be critical of Rome for its hierarchy, top-down authority, we also need to look at the church hierarchies of the Lutherans, Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, and others. And some of those denominations have more autonomy at the local level than others. I get that. I understand that. But there are quite a few pastors out there, Protestant pastors, who would like to preach on certain things and do not because it's not approved by the denomination. So let's examine our own eyes for logs before we start casting stones, to mix a couple of biblical metaphors. Anyway, look forward to talking to John Wright again, and I do appreciate his work and his willingness to put his opinions out there in the public square, which is why he drew so much attention from the social justice warriors and why, after being nominated for 5 Hugos, those 5 categories all went to Noah Ward. You put that together, just say it fast. No award, okay? They'd rather burn down the award ceremony than actually give it to somebody who professes a belief in Jesus Christ and a certain order to things according to the way God created them. Anyway, one item in the news that I want to talk about before telling you what's coming up on A View from the Bunker, and this was a story that was published by the New York Times yesterday. It is extremely disturbing. I take that back. It was published on the 21st. Which was yesterday. Okay. Out of Kabul, Afghanistan. And this just raises the question again, I think in all caps with multiple exclamation points. What are we doing there? The story is headlined, U.S. soldiers told to ignore sexual abuse of boys by Afghan allies. We've been in Afghanistan, our military, since 2001, late 2001. It was our response to 9/11. That's where Osama bin Laden was supposedly hiding. The Taliban was headquartered, and so we needed to go in and teach him a lesson. We went in. We are still there. And apparently while we are there, our soldiers are being told to turn their eyes away from certain behaviors of the men leading the Afghan forces with whom we are allied. And I'm going to quote from the story. This is the opening paragraphs of this article from the New York Times. Quote, in his last phone call home, Lance Corporal Gregory Buckley Jr. told his father what was troubling him. From his bunk in southern Afghanistan, he could hear Afghan police officers sexually abusing boys they had brought to the base. At night, we can hear them screaming, but we're not allowed to do anything about it. The Marine's father, Gregory Buckley Sr., recalled his son telling him before he was shot to death at the base in 2012. He urged his son to tell his superiors. My son said that his officers told him to look the other way because it's their culture. Rampant sexual abuse of children has long been a problem in Afghanistan, primarily among armed commanders who dominate much of the rural landscape and can bully the population. The practice is called Vaka Bazi, literally boy play. And American soldiers and Marines have been instructed not to intervene. In some cases, not even when their Afghan allies have abused boys on military bases, according to interviews and court records. The policy has endured as American forces have recruited and organized Afghan militias to help hold territory against the Taliban. But soldiers and Marines have been increasingly troubled that instead of weeding out pedophiles, the American military was arming them in some cases and placing them as the commanders of villages, and doing little when they began abusing children. The reason we were here is because we heard the terrible things the Taliban were doing to people, how they were taking away human rights, said Dan Quinn, a former Special Forces captain who beat up an American-backed militia commander for keeping a boy chained to his bed as a sex slave. But we were putting people into power who would do things that were worse than the Taliban did. That was something village elders voiced to me. The policy of instructing soldiers to ignore child sexual abuse by their Afghan allies is coming under new scrutiny, particularly as it emerges that service members like Captain Quinn have faced discipline, even career ruin, for disobeying it. After the beating, the Army relieved Captain Quinn of his command and pulled him from Afghanistan. He has since left the military. 4 years later, the Army is also trying to forcibly retire Sergeant First Class Charles Martland, a Special Forces member who joined Captain Quinn in beating up the commander. In Sergeant Martland's case, the Army said it could not comment because of the Privacy Act. Skipping down the article, the American policy of non-intervention is intended to maintain good relations with the Afghan police and militia units the United States has trained to fight the Taliban. It also reflects a reluctance to impose cultural values in a country where pederasty is rife, particularly among powerful men, for whom being surrounded by young teenagers can be a mark of social status. Some soldiers believed the policy made sense, even if they were personally distressed at the sexual predation they witnessed or heard about. Still, the former Lance Corporal who spoke on the condition of anonymity to avoid offending fellow Marines, recalled feeling sickened the day he entered a room on a base and saw three or four men lying on the floor with children between them. I'm not 100% sure what was happening under the sheet, but I have a pretty good idea of what was going on, he said. What are we doing over there? It's not enough that production of opium is at an all-time high under the watch of America's military. Now we are protecting and arming sexual predators who are abusing and raping young boys. As Billy Graham said, if the Lord does not judge America, he'll need to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. Ahead on A View from the Bunker, Mark Goodwin, PrepperRecon.com, the host of the Prepper Recon podcast, discusses his new book, Days of Noah, Book 3, Perdition. It is prepper fiction. You'll find some good tips on preparedness as National Preparedness Month continues. That will be posted on Thursday the 24th. Normally, I try to hold to a Sunday-Wednesday schedule, but we're late getting John Wright's interview to the web, so we'll hold Mark Goodwin for Thursday the 24th. On the 27th, Doug Overmeyer, SearsC.com, has an article posted in the online magazine at Skywatch TV, Parenting in the Land of Moloch. 60 million killed since Roe v. Wade. If this is not a land devoted to Moloch, I don't know what is. We'll discuss that, and that will be posted Sunday the 27th of September. And then closing out the month, an interview with Dr. Michael Heiser about his new book, The Unseen Realm, understanding the true nature of the spirit realm more deeply by understanding better the divine counsel concept. That interview posted next Wednesday, September 30th. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, continues to work through the book of Deuteronomy, and another Bible study will be posted Sunday, late morning. That's at gilberthouse.org. Find all the archives there at gilberthouse.org, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. Next week, Carl Gallup's on Skywatch TV. That is Tuesday night, 8:30 p.m. Central Time, 9:30 Eastern, on the Christian Television Network. If you've got satellite TV, that's Dish Network 376, DirecTV 376, Dish Network Channel 267. Otherwise, you can watch it online, ctnonline.com. That's the website for the Christian Television Network. Of course, after the fact, you can watch it on the official Skywatch TV Roku channel or YouTube channel, and you'll find links to those at skywatchtv.com. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is A View from the Bunker.